You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, our discussion will focus on that part of the legal world where criminal law and immigration law intersect. In particular, what challenges do non-citizens face today, especially as they are burdened with very old and very small, or at least what they were led to believe were very small, criminal convictions? What can be done to help these folks who have often lived alongside us for many, many years, raised families, and now face losing everything? With me in the studio tonight, Adam Gassner, a certified criminal law specialist out of San Francisco. And Adam works to clear these old convictions, which were often attained with the complicity of an attorney who inadequately researched or misadvised regarding the immigration consequences of a criminal conviction. And Marla Samora from the Vanderhout firm, Vanderhout LLP in San Francisco, formerly splitting her time between the Nationality Service Center and the Defender Association of Philadelphia's Immigration Unit, where she focused on the immigration consequences of criminal charges and convictions. Marla now works with Vanderhout LLP, one of, if not the premier immigration firms in the region, where she represents clients in immigration cases before the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the Immigration Court, the Board of Immigration Appeals, and in federal district and circuit courts. Her practice focuses on minimizing the immigration consequences of criminal convictions. If you have questions for my guests, a phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free. We'll pay the freight at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on the topic of criminal immigration laws. You're not limited to the exact point where we may be in the conversation. And Marla, Adam, let me welcome each of you to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Really appreciate being here on KALW and having all the listeners out there be educated on this very important topic. I think it's one that's ever-changing, and I really appreciate you taking the time to present this to our audience.
Before we go further, I'd like to start with this. Somebody pleads to a very small criminal charge that we consider a mere nuisance, and now, years later, he's got problems. Is this commonplace?
This is incredibly common. We tend to view criminal charges and convictions as something as minimal as, a theft offense or shoplifting or maybe even just possession of 30 grams or less of marijuana, which now no longer is criminalized in California. But we view these things as very minimal, usually get a slap on the wrist by the courts. And then all of a sudden, you're facing deportation as a result of those convictions. And what is very commonplace is because they're treated so minimally by the courts, a lot of criminal defense attorneys don't think that they actually have to reach out or even consider that this could impact a non-citizen.
Well, that poses a broader question. Doesn't the federal government, or more particularly Immigration and Customs Enforcement, don't they follow the state designation of how serious an offense may or may not be?
They do not. So oftentimes I always hear a client say, oh, it's just a misdemeanor. It shouldn't be a big deal, right? And unfortunately, misdemeanors in California often carry very hefty consequences by the federal government when it comes to immigration. So we always have to compare what the conduct is and what the statute you're being charged with to federal charges and federal statutes. And oftentimes, a misdemeanor can carry very, very significant consequences. So they don't, unfortunately.
I mean, really, it's a systematic problem. Because a small misdemeanor comes into a criminal defense office, and when they go to court, the interest of many lawyers is to resolve it what they think most favorably for the defendant with regards to what the criminal punishment will be. And if they're offered a diversion or a deferred entry of judgment or a quick plea with no jail, oftentimes that's the end of the inquiry. And what they don't want to do...
Let me interrupt you for a moment. Sure. For our listeners that aren't familiar, you use the phrase deferred entry of judgment. And as a criminal defense attorney, we think of that most commonly when we're talking about drug cases, but it does have other effect. And what it means, for those that aren't familiar with the phrase, is that there's no judgment entered, but you enter a plea first, and things are held aside under whatever terms, and at the end the case is dismissed. And you were using that phrase, and I wanted to plug that explanation in, but I want you to continue with what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, to clarify, in order to get a conviction in California, you need to have an entry of a plea or a finding of guilt, and then a judgment and sentence has to be imposed. Most people think that is one and the same. It's really two different pieces of procedure. And so if you split those two apart and you enter an admission of guilt or you're found guilty by a jury, but you put judgment off a certain period of time, there is a mechanism for doing certain things before the judgment and sentence were imposed, so such that instead of judgment and sentence being imposed, you can withdraw that guilty plea and dismiss the case. Again, from a criminal defense perspective, that's a great result. The case winds up being dismissed. You'd be eligible for other types of new relief to have your record sealed. And many lawyers feel like they've done their job competently. The problem is there may be a greater issue, a looming issue that they didn't realize. They haven't checked the status of their client. They don't know whether that person is a citizen or a non-citizen. And therefore, there is a bigger, scarier monster out there, which is the federal government, that regardless of your dismissal and your sealed record and you think you're on your way, when in fact that's a freight train coming at you, not a ray of light, and that's the federal government that's going to come in and detain you despite the fact you have no condition no sentence. And then what happens at that point is that you're fighting a case for deportation or otherwise from inside federal custody when you thought you had a great deal.
Again, this highlights the disconnect between the federal government and the state government, where under immigration law, the definition of a conviction is very different than the state version. And so, again, you have a lot of clients who are saying, but it's under California, I don't have a conviction. It's fine. But unfortunately, under federal law, all it takes is an entry of guilt and some imposition on your freedom or restraint imposed. So any conditions placed in order to have your case now dismissed, that would be considered sufficient for a conviction. And as a result, you have a lot of people who thought, great, now I don't have to do any, I won't be incarcerated, or now I don't have this offense and it won't impact my ability to get a job, but now they're facing deportation. And that's a conflict that I always have is with dealing with immigration consequences, is that you have a lot of people who have competing interests, and you have the interest of wanting to remain in this country with their family versus not having a felony on their record, or not having to be incarcerated and miss time from work. And so we really have to consider the full picture when we're trying to advise on these consequences and what these charges would result in.
I had a client some years back. I'll refer to him as Mr. C, who was brought here as an infant, never knew he was not born here. And his family treated him through his entire life. You're the one who was born here. We're so proud. You could actually be president someday. Until after he accepted deferred entry of judgment and was invited for an interview, at which point they put the handcuffs on. And not only did he find out that he was, his attorney advised him correctly. His attorney did everything right. But he was given such bad information, he gave the attorney bad information and didn't tell him he was a non-citizen. I bring this up because it begs the obvious question. Suppose somebody didn't know they were a citizen or that they were a non-citizen. Is there any relief for them at all? I know in the past there wasn't. Has that changed?
In terms of immigration law, in the context of getting post-conviction sort of relief...
Let's start first with immigration law.
Okay. With immigration law, at this point, if you thought you were a citizen this whole time and then entered into a deal thinking that you were a citizen, your problem first has to be addressed within the criminal courts to get that fixed based on the fact that you've now discovered that you weren't properly advised. And hopefully there you can find a vehicle to get your conviction reversed. And it's an interesting question, and I think one of the things that we did in the Philadelphia Defender's Office was There are questions that you ask oftentimes because we're limited by records, limited by access, because, again, you have somebody who's either in jail or just doesn't have the resources or the means to gather what we call through a Freedom of Information Act request, which is their basically their record. We ask certain questions about their parents when they came here. We ask whether they even have their birth certificate. We really try to inquire the best we can and really impress upon them that, you know, the fact that your parents are foreign-born brings into doubt your status. And without seeing a birth certificate or U.S. passport, you know, we really can't advise you as a citizen yet. And again, that's where the problem happens, because when somebody's a citizen, a criminal defense attorney can be a lot more creative in dealing with their case. But when you have somebody who is facing deportation or not or being barred from immigration relief, sometimes the best course is actually entering into a plea or taking a charge that actually has worse convictions criminally than they actually do for immigration purposes. And that's an interesting disconnect that happens a lot in practice.
And how does that look in state law? Are there new devices or ways to deal with that?
Absolutely. I mean, it is very true that we're hindered by the information that we have. And it's very difficult, to Marla's point, for a criminal defense lawyer to understand that there are occasions when you want to convict somebody of a more serious charge. That really runs counter to most criminal defense lawyers' instincts. Mm-hmm. But the bigger picture needs to be viewed, and that can be quite complicated and very difficult to explain. There is no easily accessible national database to just look and see what the status of your client is. You have to rely on the information that you have. In your context, Jeff, that information was wrong. In our context, we're often lied to out of fear. But now, effective January 1st, 2017, there was a new California law that will help people erase sort of catastrophic consequences that can attach to even very old convictions. Penal Code 1473.7 is a new-ish law still being understood by practitioners. Some know it well, some don't. It's kind of jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But if any listener has a very old conviction and they're concerned about it, or they know somebody that has an old conviction and they're concerned about it, you have to know that 1473.7 does provide you with some relief. It permits people that are no longer in criminal custody to file a motion to vacate a conviction or sentence based on either of one of two claims. So pardon me for reading the statute, but a prejudicial error damaging the defendant's ability to meaningfully understand, defend against, or knowingly accept the actual or potential adverse immigration consequences of a plea of guilty or nolo contendere, or newly discovered evidence of actual innocence. So we'll put aside newly discovered evidence of actual innocence and focus on prong one. In this instance, there are plenty of actual or potential adverse immigration consequences that people face with an old conviction. The law could have changed since then. They could have been poorly advised in the past. So now people can bring a motion in criminal court to vacate even a very old criminal conviction, and they should be participating in this. These convictions need to be vacated if the person's immigration consequences are at issue. And even if they're living comfortably, happily in the U.S. today, that might not be how they're living tomorrow. In our administration, the law doesn't just change year to year. The law seems to change day to day or tweet to tweet. So I would suggest that it's a very powerful piece of legislation. It's a very powerful law, and it is in some respects a sympathetic piece of law, but it is not being used as commonly as it should, and it's being, there is difficulty getting some courts to believe that there's priority here, and getting district attorney's offices and probation offices to provide the requisite information or to go ahead and not object to these type of motions. So I think it's incumbent on anyone that is has a criminal conviction, that doesn't have status in this country of a naturalized citizen or a U.S. citizen, to think long and hard, even if they're living comfortably day to day, on what could happen tomorrow. And this law is helpful and is useful, and in the right context, it can really save the day.
Go ahead.
I'll let you finish that thought.
Oh, I was going to say, I absolutely agree. And it's not just within the context of possibly facing deportation. I have plenty of clients who want to apply for naturalization, but as we were discussing, the law is changing, policies are changing, wherein before somebody may have had an offense that would have made them inadmissible or deportable, but because it was in the past, they've been a lawful permanent resident, the immigration would process like an application for naturalization because of through discretion. But under the Trump administration, they're now employing a policy in which if deportability is discovered, you're automatically being referred to removal proceedings. And so this is a mechanism that actually just worked for one of my clients who had a conviction that he got immigration relief in the court, but because of the nature of the conviction, he was forever barred from naturalizing. He just successfully got this motion litigated, and so now we can apply affirmatively for naturalization, and he's a very happy person because once you become a citizen, you no longer face that threat of deportation, barring minor exceptions.
I'm Jeff Hayden. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. Tonight we're discussing challenges that non-citizens face when burdened with very old and sometimes very small criminal convictions and where there might be some help. With me in the studio tonight are Adam Gassner, certified criminal law specialist from San Francisco, and from Vanderhout LLP, which is one of, if not the premier immigration firm in the region, Marla Samora. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free. We will pay for the freight. We would love to hear from you. Our number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on criminal and immigration law. You're not limited to the exact point where we may be in our conversation. Again, if you're outside San Francisco, the number here is 866-798-8255. So we were talking about new law that California created. What else can California do? What else has it done?
Well, they've done several things. One example would be the California Penal Code 18.5, which retroactively changed the definition of a misdemeanor to mean less than 365 days.
Why is that important? Why does it matter if it's 365 or 364 or 366?
No, it's incredibly important because under immigration law, there is an exception to it's called the petty offense exception that would enable people to remain eligible for relief or and not necessarily be deportable. And what it requires is for if you've been convicted of a misdemeanor where the maximum sentence imposed possible is less than 365 days and you serve less than 6 months and are sentenced to less than 6 months, this will not have immigration consequences for you per se. So it's a really helpful definition. It applies right now currently, even though California applies it retroactively, it applies prospectively for people who are now convicted under California under a California misdemeanor. Unfortunately, there was a decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals that held that even if California applies it retroactively, they're looking at what the definition of the misdemeanor was at the time of conviction. So this is still being litigated. There are plenty of people who, I imagine, thought this was going to be incredibly helpful. I had a client in particular who was now going to be eligible for a particular form of relief that's now changed since this board decision has come down, and we're waiting for it to be litigated. So, for anybody who has been in removal proceedings or who only has a conviction for a misdemeanor that was barring them from relief, it's possible that may change in the future.
I mean, it cannot be overstated enough how important that law is and how proactive the legislature was in California in trying to enact this. Misdemeanors in California, by definition, are crimes that maximum punishment is a year or less. Almost all of them have a punishment of a year Some of them have a punishment of 6 months, and very few have less than that as a maximum possible punishment. So therefore, with this new law, everybody, by definition, who got a year or less sentence would be have immigration consequences because 365 days is the definition of a year. The legislature, in their wisdom, really aimed at helping immigrants in California, defined a year as 364 days, a legal fiction in some ways, or maybe a practical fiction in some days, but really an attempt, an endeavor by our legislature to assist in this very difficult situation. And therefore, anybody that had a misdemeanor in California, any misdemeanor in California, would be getting relief. And now we're seeing pushback, despite the fact that there was retroactivity, we're seeing pushback from the federal government trying to not allow our state legislature to assist in this very difficult situation. I think we're seeing that in California and nationally.
And let me turn it over to Sean in San Francisco. Welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights. Sean, if you can hear me, you're on the air. We must have lost Sean. We will, Sean, if you can hear me, feel free to call us back. We would love to hear what you had to say. And for those that are wishing they were listening or paying attention, we do have a halftime score. At this point, the Warriors are closing that what looked like an insurmountable lead. It's now the Raptors 60, Warriors 52 at halftime. So we talked about some of the things that California has done to make charges appear a little less serious. Let me talk about charges that might be a little more serious. When we think of a felony, we tend to think of something that's fairly serious. We think of things such as robberies or residential burglaries and the like. Is the same true for immigration analysis? Do they draw these lines in the same places?
They don't. They have their own definitions of what offenses will carry consequences. There are crimes that they consider as crimes involving moral turpitude, which is very vague and defined purely through case law. There is a list of what they define as aggravated felonies. So that's often defined by either sentence or amount of loss. So, for example, if you have a theft offense where they sentence you to a year or more, regardless of how much time you've spent or whether the sentence was suspended, you now have what's considered an aggravated felony, which is one of the most serious kinds of consequences you can have. It results in mandatory detention. It bars most forms of relief, including asylum. It carries a heavy burden for something that may have been a loss of, a couple hundred dollars that can now result in separation and being barred from coming back to the United States. So they have very different definitions, and it's something that's consistently being litigated because as immigration practitioners, in order to determine the consequences of state offenses, we have to compare a state statute to a federal statute. And sometimes they're the exact same. Sometimes the state statute's broader and encompasses more conduct than the federal statute, and sometimes it doesn't. So we have to look at all of those in order to assess whether it carries immigration consequences. So it's a very complicated analysis. It's not just, is it a misdemeanor? Is it a felony?
Felonies in California have a widest range of possible punishments you could believe. They're merely defined as a felony in California if you're eligible to go to state prison on that crime. But that could be something like petty offense, petty theft with a prior, something that maybe, shoplifting, where you had previously been convicted of shoplifting on a number of occasions, all the way up to, first-degree premeditated homicide. So you're looking at a range of punishments from, say, 16 months to life without the possibility of parole. So we have to define in that huge sea of felonies which ones have immigration consequences and which ones don't. And to Marla's point earlier, a savvy criminal practitioner would understand that maybe a second-degree burglary might be a better offense to plead to than even a misdemeanor that carried a year or a misdemeanor that was considered a crime of moral turpitude, which is generally defined as a crime that goes to your ability to be a truth teller. not just breaking a regulatory law, right? Mm-hmm. So the reality is that this isn't an area that criminal defense lawyers study in law school. We don't learn it in criminal law. We don't learn it in criminal procedure. We don't learn it in evidence. And frankly, many of us don't learn it in the offices of the public defender or the district attorney's office or in private practice. It's a moving area. It's very fluid. And most criminal defense lawyers, frankly, have a lot to learn. They have a lot to learn from their co-counsel and their counsel on the immigration side. I mean, that's why we call it crimmigration sometimes. The crossover is enormous. And it's been an area that changes from day to day. So, you know, for the listeners out there, you have to understand that what you thought was the law when you talked to your lawyer 6 months ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, and 10 years ago is not necessarily the case in 2019. We're all learning it as we go. So I would implore anybody that has a criminal conviction in California that doesn't have status as a U.S. citizen to get educated on where you stand.
One of the things I tell my own clients that are non-citizens, and to me that's one of the first questions I ask, is are you a citizen? If they're not a citizen, I always tell them before you look for any type of adjustment of your status, seek an immigration attorney, because what I tell you today may be different when you check in 1 year or 2 years or 5 years or even 6 months. It's pretty fluid. Most defense attorneys should have access to someone to go to, whether it's an immigration attorney friend, whether it's calling the Immigrants Legal Resource Center, which is a phenomenal resource here in San Francisco. You need to get that information from somebody on the front lines and not rely on what you learned 2 years ago or 10 years ago, because it's pretty dynamic and it changes. What's an aggravated felony in immigration terms?
So an aggravated felony is actually a list under USC 1101A43, and the main ones are theft offenses that carry a sentence of a year or more, sexual assault offenses, sexual abuse of a minor offense, fraud offenses. I think I might, did I say the fraud offenses, loss of 10,000. So the obstruction of justice. So they have all of, they have an enumerated list, and they're rather vaguely defined. And so we have to look at how the California statute compares to those. And it's interesting because there was actually just a recent decision by the Supreme Court on our statutory rape offense and found that it wasn't an aggravated felony because of the mismatch in the statutes and what the conduct was being which conduct was being criminalized and which one wasn't. So again, a very counterintuitive result when it seems that, oh, but this should fall under this. So that's where you would look. Aggravated felonies have severe consequences attached to them. Let me see if I can pull them up. But one example is you're barred from most forms of relief. You are subject to mandatory detention. And this applies to lawful permanent residents as well. For lawful permanent residents, one of the main forms of relief is something called cancellation of removal for lawful permanent residents. And one of the conditions is that you have not been convicted of an aggravated felony.
And an aggravated felony under federal law may be a misdemeanor under California law.
Exactly. So it's really important to assess your status and to get your records pulled. And unfortunately, sometimes you get things expunged or sealed and now the records are lost. And oftentimes, right now under the state of the law, the burden is unfortunately on you to show that you were not convicted of something.
And this is sort of a critical issue procedurally for many people. I had a client that took a deferred entry of judgment on a shoplifting, resulted in no conviction, normally a successful resolution in a criminal matter, not a successful resolution in an immigration matter. Subsequent to having the case dismissed under the California CARE Act, this person was eligible to have their arrest record and their court records sealed. Later, they did have them sealed and later went to their immigration lawyer to talk about their status, and that lawyer requested, you guessed it, certified records from the court of what occurred. When she called the court said, we have no file on you. So even though the federal government might be able to know and look into what you have done and what your record is, the individual doesn't have access themselves. This is a horrifying problem. They don't have a record, the police record sealed, the court record is sealed, but the eye in the sky, the big brother, the federal government, looks down and is able to pull from their national databases information that the actual person doesn't have access to.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So we're talking criminal law and immigration. Non-citizens burdened with sometimes very old or very small convictions, how this can burden them. If you have questions for my guests, call us in the studio at 415-841-4134 or toll-free at 866-798-8255. We'll pay the freight. Join us just as Aaron has. Aaron from Oakland, you're on Your Legal Rights.
Okay, good evening. So I learned not that long ago that the judges, the immigration judges who rule on people's immigration cases are actually not members of the judiciary. They're actually agents of the executive branch. And that seems like a conflict of interest. It seems confusing and almost deceptive to me. I wonder if you could clarify what the case is there and if there are ethical issues that result.
That's a good question. And Aaron, I think that question's going to take us a few minutes to delve into, because we'll give you the specific of what it means in this context, but also the general of the difference between administrative law and judicial. So I hope you'll take your answer off the air. I think this will be of some use to you.
Okay, but, I will do that.
But generally, you're correct. They are not actually judges. And in fact, the majority of judges I appear before actually used to be government counsel for the Immigration Customs Enforcement, for Department of Homeland Security, who were litigating the cases against my clients. So there is definitely a huge conflict of interest. And in fact, the attorney general is their boss and gets to direct a lot of how they decide cases. So it's a huge problem, absolutely. And I think we can delve into a little bit deeper off the air.
But isn't this very comparable to a lot of other areas where you're not necessarily reaching the court yet? You're dealing with some administrative decision, whether it's the Department of Motor Vehicles or some other administrative agency on employment, where you get an administrative law judge who is at a lower tier than perhaps a sitting Superior Court judge or Article III judge in the federal system. Where do you go for relief?
Well, from there, if there is an adverse decision from the immigration judge, then you would have to appeal to the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is also ruled by the Attorney General, essentially, and appointed by the Attorney General. And another interesting point, that even if you win your case in immigration court, it's not like criminal court where, great, you're now acquitted. The government can actually appeal any grant by the immigration judge himself. So oftentimes we'll have judges being reversed on an exercise of their discretion by the board when you thought your client had just won their case. So once you go to the Board of Immigration Appeals and they issue a decision, if it's adverse to you, then your option is to go to the Ninth Circuit or to whatever circuit court you're in. So it results in fact, in a lot of circuit splits within the United States, which basically means you may be fine in one jurisdiction, but if you move to another jurisdiction, you may have issues based on your conviction and the way the court is treating it.
And Aaron, this is a big problem from immigration all the way down to hearings at the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Yes.
Administrative law judges are pervasive in our country. They're appointed usually. Some of them don't necessarily even have law degrees, if you could believe this. Sometimes they were practitioners for the very people when they were lawyers that were prosecuting your case before they became an administrative law judge. We call that a prosecutor with a robe on. So there are a lot of difficulties. They swear oaths to be impartial. You can judge for yourself whether that is in fact what's going on in our immigration courts. It is a couple of steps of appeal before you get to a circuit court, where you get to an Article III, which is a judge appointed by Article 3 of the Constitution for life. These judges hopefully actually judge and actually have impartial views or attempt to be impartial, but this is pervasive. It permeates our society, and you see it at all levels. It would be very difficult to change. Sometimes we have to deal with the cards we're dealt.
For example, the San Francisco Immigration Court just got a new immigration judge who was a prosecutor in the Chicago Black Site cases, who was complicit in torture based on, you know, a lot of these documents. And he's now going to be presiding over my case, which is a convention against torture case where my client fears torture going back to her home country. So clearly issues there as to how people are being appointed. And I think it highlights systemically why it's been prioritized to fill the federal seats, to fill all of these positions under this administration, because they're going to be the ones shaping the law for generations to come in a lot of ways. So it's really it's a big problem, and we're going to see it continuously get worse as decisions get affirmed, or as precedents get reversed, and we see a new shape of the judiciary.
So whether this administration is over in just over a year and a half, or if they're there for 5.5 years, either way, they're going to have an effect, a ripple effect that's going to affect for generations.
Absolutely.
On that cheery note, I'm Jeff Hayden. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. Tonight, we're discussing challenges non-citizens face today when burdened with criminal convictions that might be very, very small or very old, and where there might be some relief for them. With me in the studio tonight, from Vanderhout LLP, which is one of, if not the premier immigration firms in the region, Marla Samora, with extensive experience in dealing with exactly this issue, and also sitting to her right, Adam Gassner, a certified criminal law specialist, certified by the Board of Legal Specialization, State Bar of California, and also very familiar with this area and helping people get relief. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 841-4134. But if you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you're not stuck with exactly where we are in the conversation. You can call regarding any question related to criminal immigration law. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. And with that, let me turn it over to Arian out of San Francisco. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you. I just have a comment or two. I did my academic research on the criminalization of people of color. And I think it's important for us to understand that in this country we think about crime and punishment together. And some of these crimes are very ordinary, like shoplifting for food or trespassing or having a mental illness, which could be a product of traumatic military interventions that the U.S. has promulgated in their countries, or a painful immigration experience. So I wish there was more of a mental health focus and a greater sense of responsibility for our impact in these lands where, in fact, in California, we're all living on Mexican land, if we consider that it was such before 1848 when we took it in a war. It just seems like it's filled with hypocrisy and a tendency to favor property rights and privilege over true justice, which goes beyond laws as they're written today.
Thank you very much, Arian, for that, and I wholeheartedly agree. As a native San Franciscan, our brothers and sisters to the south of us bring a rich culture that indeed was here before Eastern and Western Europeans came to the United States. And so that culture should be respected and appreciated and embraced in a way that it's not. It's very clear that the immigration laws adversely affect predominantly people of color, certainly in our state, predominantly brown people from Mexico and South America. And it's terrifying. I think you make an excellent point, and you're seeing the laws inordinately affecting those people. And I think it is political, and I think it does have to do with property rights. I wholeheartedly agree. We've got about 13 million undocumented, I think, if my number's correct, in this country. They're vital to the fabric of our well-being. They're a part of us. They're not us versus them. It is we. And I really agree with that. But that's a political fight that we need to engage in. Here in the trenches or day-to-day, what we're trying to do is one person at a time. One person who has a conviction, one person who has a family member that has an old conviction that they're hiding or embarrassed about, need to come to light. They have to talk to an immigration lawyer. They have to talk to a criminal lawyer. They have to figure out what their rights are, even if it's a small, petty offense, even if it's an offense from 10, 20 years ago. They need to come out in the privacy of an attorney-client privilege setting and have that conversation. So in the small picture, we need to help each individual. In the big picture, we need to change policy.
Arian, thank you for joining us. I hope we were of some help to you. But I'll turn it to you, Marla. Arian brought one thing up that is of concern to me. Arian brought up having more of a mental health focus. But at least under current law, if somebody says, I had a mental health condition that perhaps makes me less culpable, doesn't that perhaps work against them in an immigration context?
Well, there is a public health health ground of inadmissibility where they actually do affirmatively ask whether you've ever been confined as a result of that. So it can be problematic. I think are you asking in terms of the criminal conviction or like trying to maneuver the charges and discussing that? Or I'm a little confused by the question. Sorry.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is if somebody brings up the fact that they've got a mental health a condition that puts them in worse shape, in a criminal context, we often think of that as mitigating or making it less serious. But if we create a record of that and that comes to the attention of immigration authorities, doesn't that put them in actually a worse light in some lights because that in and of itself is a ground for them to take action against the person?
It can go both ways. Sometimes we're able to use it effectively and negotiating discretion, but it can go in an opposite way if it's found that they're going to be a threat to public safety. And that can go with regards in context of bond. If somebody has shown to have a mental health issue that, you know, puts the immigration makes them uneasy about their ability to be free, then they could remain in custody without bond. So, and it is a ground of inadmissibility, as I just said before. So I think to your broader point, we have to consistently be very careful about what's in the record with regards to anything like mental health, who the relation, if it's an assault crime, who the victim was. There's a lot of careful crafting of that.
I would say in the criminal law context, too, this is something that's also counterintuitive in our practice. We often want to use mental health issues as a mitigating factor. They should be a mitigating factor. The mentally ill in this country are effectively dealt with in the criminal justice system now. They're not dealt with in the mental health system and the Departments of Health and Human Services any longer. So we effectively have enormous numbers of people with varying degrees of mental illness coming through our doors every day. And we have opportunities in the criminal justice system through our mental health diversion courts and otherwise to provide them with a path to a good result in criminal court, but we are exposing their mental health issues on the record every court appearance or in filings, which then are going to have adverse consequences if they have an issue with regard to their immigration status. For another issue that comes up all the time is that there are people, and in San Francisco you might be aware that they're trying to widen the use of what we call Welfare and Institution Code 5150 holds, an involuntary hold of somebody.
And that's going to be a big part of our show next week is conservatorship. So even forgetting the criminal stuff on the civil side, what it means to conserve somebody, what relief valves are out there for your family members that might have a mental health problem, maybe can't take care of themselves because of it, where you can go. But that's next week. But I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you weren't.
You brought that up.
That's just a preview, and I think next week's show will be very interesting. It's very topical. San Francisco's looking at it right now. I think Berkeley is looking at it also. So we'll be very interested to see how that turns. But right now, if you're a danger to yourself or others, you can be involuntarily held for up to 72 hours. There is new legislation you'll discuss in more detail that I think will broaden that quite a bit. And we will see a lot more of the mentally ill people being conserved and being held involuntarily. There are arguments both ways for that. We look forward to that discussion.
And I would be remiss not to mention, again, the disconnect between federal and state law and not discussing California's decriminalization of marijuana. As you all know, it's still criminalized federally. And so for anybody who's a non-citizen, marijuana use is still considered a very adverse factor. You may not necessarily have a conviction for it in California now, but any use, it can be discovered at a naturalization interview, at an interview for your adjustment of status, or anytime you're applying for relief. And it looks like the administration is actually training their officers to delve into that, and particularly in states where it has been decriminalized. So again, for anybody who's a non-citizen and may or is considering marijuana use in states where it's legal, you should really consult with your immigration attorney and realize that it could be very problematic for you in the future.
And I think something that should always be remembered in this context is that it is decriminalized in California. So we have a state courthouse, but about 10 blocks away, we have a federal courthouse. And in federal courthouse, that same substance, cannabis, is still quite unlawful, still Schedule I drug nationally. So there is this dichotomy. So people feel free to use cannabis medically, feel free to use cannabis recreationally. Think of it as a lawful substance, maybe similar to alcohol, but it's not. The federal government still has the same penalties, the same mandatory minimums, and from this administration looks like the same vigor to prosecute those types of cases. So things aren't all as peaceful as they seem.
They seem it because we've been using that now legalized marijuana, so everything's kind of mellow. I'm Jeff Hayden. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. Tonight, we're discussing challenges non-citizens face today when burdened with perhaps small or very old convictions. They were led to believe they're very small, but the trouble they face today may not be so small. With me in the studio tonight, Adam Gassner, certified criminal law specialist out of San Francisco, and from Vanderhout LLP, which is the premier, or certainly one of the premier immigration firms in the region, Marla Zamora. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're not in San Francisco, call us toll-free. Let us pay the freight, 866-798-8255. There's still a couple minutes that you can get a call in to us. It's 866-798-8255. And as always, you may call regarding any question on criminal and immigration law. You're not limited to jump in where we may be in our discussions. Again, if you're outside San Francisco, that's 866-798-8255. And we were talking a bit earlier, and Adam brought up a case that did not result in a conviction and still created problems. And I've come to learn that there's a whole category of such cases. We all think about innocent until proven guilty, and that's certainly the case in a criminal trial, perhaps not all the pretrial proceedings, but certainly at a trial. But I've come to learn that in certain areas of immigration law, they look at a reason to believe. Can you talk a little bit about what that means and when it applies?
Yes, there is a nasty little ground of inadmissibility called reason to believe to be a drug trafficker. And it's the government's burden to prove this, but what can result in this being applied to you is they may see that you have multiple arrests for drug possession, even if it didn't result in a conviction, or basically looking at your criminal history or any admissions that you may have made about any use or associations. And there's no waiver for this, and it's very problematic. And in fact, one of my colleagues has a client now who is now being charged with that after he got his conviction vacated for legal defect, which is a valid under immigration law, but now they're trying to attach this reason to believe to be a drug trafficker ground against him in order to effectuate his deportation. So it's one of these grounds that can be applied at the border. So if you have any drug arrests, it's really important to consult with an immigration attorney before any travel. I know in the past, you've probably traveled fine, but under this administration, they really ramped up deferred inspection, which is what happens when you come to the airport. They may put you in secondary. There's a lot that's going on now in terms of enforcement, and it's just you have to be very careful about this one ground, especially if you have any arrests related to drug abuse or to a controlled substance.
Everybody that has traveled internationally in the last several years might have noticed that on the one hand, there are some streamlined processes, the GOES process or whatnot, TSA PreCheck, which may speed you through the process. But really, behind the scenes, the secondary screening is ramped up enormously. If you have a petty offense that's open, that's lingering, you may be free to travel and you may be readmitted to this country. But you can be sure that when you go through customs in your port of entry, that you are going to be pulled aside and you are going to be questioned. And you often should have documents on your person, even a letter from your lawyer indicating the case is open or indicating the status of your appeal or indicating stating the status of where your case is procedurally, because it is occurring all the time. People, to citizens, to non-citizens, are getting that secondary screening at those ports of entry. And you should be aware, if you have an old conviction, certainly an old drug conviction that you thought was no big deal, small case, old case, hasn't been a problem. You haven't traveled in several years. Wait till you try to come back to the United States. At your port of entry, you will be questioned in all likelihood. So it's the type of thing where, you know, reason to believe, and whose reason is this? This is the reason of an individual person sitting at a checkpoint area based on very little evidence. So you can understand it's very subjective, and that subjectivity is not going to be weighed in your favor. It's going to be weighed in you to your detriment. So you need to focus on this and think about it before you leave the country. If you have an old conviction, a small conviction, it would be incumbent upon you to look at what your rights are before you take that trip.
One of the ironies I find in my practice is when I talk to somebody who's come from another land and they're less familiar with our justice system, to try to convey to them that the fact that they've been accused doesn't mean they're guilty. The fact that they have a right to a trial doesn't mean they have a right to go to court like we are right now. It really encompasses a process that they're very unfamiliar with, even though they may not let on that they're unfamiliar. And it really takes some doing to explain to them that a trial means you have a right to a jury, that you pull people out of the community to decide these things, and that it's really the burden of the state to prove otherwise. And some people want to roll over because they're used to a system where you've been accused and therefore it's all decided already. And it troubles me that some of the convictions that I've looked at sometimes years later and had to undo might not have occurred if somebody knew the system and knew their rights. Have you experienced that?
Absolutely. I mean, I experienced that even within the immigration context, where the government has nothing to prove their burden, and we just push back and deny all of the allegations until they fold or they produce what they're supposed to do. And we've actually had cases terminated as a result of that. Unfortunately, oftentimes an attorney might see, well, they're eligible for relief, so we'll just admit and then, you know, go through the process. But with this administration, we have to push back on everything and make them and really hold them to their burden. And I think, to your point, within the criminal context, there are cases where, and I always ask, whenever I worked as a defender, I would always ask the public defender, well, what kind of evidence does a DA have? for this case. I mean, really, we need to really figure out this strategy, and maybe there's a benefit to actually pushing them to trial, because you actually might get an even better deal that you laughed at me when I first proposed it. So I think it's an important element of practice to really push back on them and making sure they meet their burden.
There's an old adage in criminal law, which is, good things happen when you announce ready for trial. and I wholeheartedly agree. I think that it is, unfortunately, nationally a product of numbers. Many misdemeanants are serviced by very earnest and excellently skilled public defenders who are also horrifyingly overworked. And so a case that that might have some small defenses if it was pushed and turned and defended to the bitter end might turn out to have a good result. But I've heard it all too often, even in the private law context, do I really need a lawyer, Mr. Gazer? I'm just going to get the same deal anyway, right? I should just plead guilty at the first appearance. I don't want to deal with this. It's going to be the same result. It's cynical. They're jaded. They're upset. And so the reality is that there are many charges that for which there may have been a defense, or there may have been an opportunity, if you'd pushed it to trial, to get that courthouse steps deal, the deal that is just a product of numbers. It happens every day, and there are plenty of people out there that didn't or weren't afforded that opportunity.
As the Warriors slide into the fourth quarter and hopefully pull out a miracle, we're sliding into the end of the hour. I'd like to give each of you about a minute, no more than that, but about a minute to sum up any last thoughts that you might have. Marla, would you like to jump in?
Sure. If you are a non-citizen and have any sort of arrests or charges, always speak to an immigration attorney before you do anything affirmative with the U.S. government, before you travel. Just one follow-up point to you, I think. When another contribution is sort of the cash bail system has resulted in a lot of people just taking deals because they don't want to spend another time, a day in jail. But it's just, it's a really, under this administration, we've really seen an amping up of enforcement. They've really consolidated databases, so old convictions from other jurisdictions are being brought to light again. So you have to be very, very careful now. And one of the best things you can do if you're a non-citizen is request your record and see what's in there. Really find out whether there is a problematic offense there, because the law has changed. Something that wasn't problematic may now be problematic, or vice versa.
Adam?
Yeah, thank you very much, Jeff. I really enjoyed the program, Marla. Your insights are incredible. I'm really honored to be a part of the panel with you. I would say, as the title of the show is here on KALW, these are your legal rights. As Marla was just saying, get your file. Talk to your old lawyer. Talk to a new lawyer if you can't find that lawyer, or if you don't like or can't get communication with your criminal lawyer. I expunge cases, set aside cases, and work to vacate old convictions for plenty of clients that weren't my clients. But if not me, find a qualified lawyer and know your legal rights.
Thank you both. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we discussed the myriad challenges non-citizens face when burdened with criminal convictions, even when very old and very small, and where there might be some help. With me in the studio tonight, Adam Gazner, certified criminal law specialist out of San Francisco, and from Vanderhout LLP, Marla Samora. Thank you once again for joining us. Next week on Your Legal Rights, what do we do with those who, because of mental illness, can't take care of themselves any longer? Again, thank you to Marla Samora and Adam Gazner for joining us. And our thanks to you for listening, and to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden, and thank you for listening, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.